This is Audible.
Gildan Media, a division of Recorded Books, presents U.S. History for Dummies, 4th Edition, by Steve Wiegand, narrated by Al Kessel. Publisher's Note: This audiobook has bonus material, which is available at dummies.com/go/get-access. You will see a drop-down menu and an option for the audiobook edition of this book, U.S. History for Dummies, 4th Edition. The code phrase for accessing this bonus material is Liberty and Freedom, in all lowercase letters. Limited Liability, Disclaimer of Warranty. The publisher and author make no representations or warranties with respect to the accuracy or completeness of the contents of this work, and specifically disclaim all warranties, including without limitation, warranties of fitness for a particular purpose. No warranty may be created or extended by sales or promotional materials. The advice and strategies contained herein may not be suitable for every situation. This work is sold with the understanding that the publisher is not engaged in rendering legal, accounting, or other professional services. If professional assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. Neither the publisher nor the author shall be liable for damages arising herefrom. The fact that an organization or website is referred to in this work as a citation and/or a potential source of further information does not mean that the author or the publisher endorses the information the organization or website may provide or recommendations it may make. Further, readers should be aware that Internet websites listed in this work may have changed or disappeared between when this work was written and when it is read. Introduction. Those who cannot remember the past, said American philosopher George Santayana, are condemned to repeat it. Generally in the 12th grade. Lots of people think of learning U.S. history as a punishment. It's a subject you had to take in school. You memorized a bewildering array of dates, absorbed definitions for terms like manifest destiny, and wondered whether America really needed two presidents named Harrison. Historical figures were presented as if they were characters in a junior high school costume pageant. Their blemishes were airbrushed out, and their personalities were drained away. Sure, you were taught George Washington warned the country about foreign entanglements in his farewell address, but it might have been more interesting to also learn he never actually gave that speech. It was printed in the newspapers. Washington didn't like giving speeches, partly because of his false teeth, which were not made of wood, but of hippopotamus ivory. Alas, textbooks often overlook the fascinating moments and details of U.S. history. They present it as something dry and distant. Events, facts, trends, movements, and don't focus on what it really is. U.S. history is the story of people, what they thought, did, and tried to do, what they ate and drank, what made them angry, and what made them laugh. About this book. This book is not a textbook, nor is it an exhaustive encyclopedia covering everything that ever happened in the United States. Instead, it focuses on people, famous and infamous, well-known and obscure. It gives you a basic foundation of information about U.S. history. You can use it as a handy reference, haul it off the shelf to settle an argument, or to start one. Which brings me to a key point. This book is not 100% straight down to the middle you'll agree with everything objective. Although I've tried to stick to the facts, or at least the most widely accepted historical interpretations of the facts, the bottom line is that my own thoughts, biases, and interpretations will inevitably intrude. It happens in every nonfiction book ever written. Sorry. If you think something is factually wrong, please let me know. If you just don't agree with something, object. You're reaffirming one of the best things about America, the right to freely express indignation. Because U.S. history hasn't always been bright and shining, especially when it comes to topics such as slavery or the treatment of Native Americans, this book doesn't always deal with pleasant or uplifting subjects. Some of what you read may anger you, sadden you, or even make you feel a little ashamed. In that regard, America's history shares something in common with just about every country ever. But the truth is that overall, America's story is a positive one. For a nation in its third century, America still does a whole lot of things right. One of them is recognizing past mistakes and generally, and sometimes gradually, striving to do it better. Enough time on the soapbox. I'm also happy to report you can find things in this book that you won't find in other U.S. history books, which may or may not be a good thing depending on your sense of humor or taste for trivia. Although they may be of little importance in the overall scheme of things, they're kind of fun to know and trot out at dinner with your boring in-laws. Some examples. The Civil War general whose name helped to popularize a common term for prostitutes, Joseph Hooker. Which canned meat product helped win World War II? Spam. And the Major League Baseball team that overcame the curse of a man with a goat, Chicago Cubs. And if you're a history purist, I think there's a mention of Manifest Destiny in here somewhere. Foolish Assumptions. I'm assuming you picked up this book because you have some interest in U.S. history, which is why I chose the title. But it doesn't matter if you know a little or a lot about the subject. I think you may enjoy it either way, even if it's just to settle arguments about the Louisiana Purchase, Chapter 7, or what Iceland had to do with the Great Recession, Chapter 22. Enough facts are in here to make this a good, if I do say so myself, basic U.S. history book, and enough trivia to irritate party guests who won't go home. Beyond the Book. You got more than you bargained for when you bought this book. In addition to what you're reading right now, this product also comes with a free Access Anywhere cheat sheet that puts scads of facts about U.S. history at your fingertips. You'll be able to make substantive points in discussions about politics, impress potential employers as a well-rounded individual, and convince people you actually remember something from the 11th grade. To get this cheat sheet, simply go to dummies.com and search for U.S. History for Dummies 4th Edition Cheat Sheet in the search box. This product also comes with an online test bank of practice questions to test your knowledge. To gain access to the online practice, 1. Find your PIN access code. Print book users. If you purchased a print copy of this book, turn to the inside front cover of the book to find your access code. E-book users. If you purchase this book as an e-book, you can get your access code by registering your e-book at dummies.com/go/get-access. Go to this website, find your book, and click on it. Answer the security questions to verify your purchase. You'll receive an email with your access code. 2. Go to dummies.com and click on Activate Now. 3. Find your product and then follow the on-screen prompts to activate your PIN. For audiobook listeners, please refer to the publisher's note in the very beginning of this book. Icons used in this book. Throughout the book, you will hear verbalized icons that alert you to particular aspects or features of history. Here's what they mean. Technical stuff. The names, numbers, and other stats behind the news are the focus of this icon. Remember. This icon alerts you to a fact or idea that you may want to stash in your memory bank. Where to go from here? Congratulations! By reading this far, you've already learned something about U.S. history. It doesn't bite, induce deep comas, or poke you in the eye with a sharp stick. Continue on, and you may get the itch to keep going even further. Remember, history is the story of people, and people are the most interesting story of all. Part 1. Getting Started with U.S. History. In this part, the early settlers make their way in a new land. The colonies establish themselves. The American Revolution leads to the creation of a new country. Chapter 1. America, a Short Biography. In this chapter, tracing America's roots, establishing a national identity, dealing with growing pains, fighting wars of a different kind, donning a new look for a new millennium. Long before it was a nation, America was an idea, a dream, a fanciful tale. For most of humankind's history, it didn't exist as anything but a blank slate, waiting to be filled. Eventually, it was filled, with people who came for all sorts of reasons and with all sorts of ideas on how to assemble a country. Sometimes the ideas and the people clashed. But out of the clashes and struggles grew a country founded on a system of government that made it unique in the world. America was lucky to have great leaders in bad times when it most needed them. It had abundant natural resources, generally peaceable neighbors, and plenty of room to grow. And boy, did it grow! But before all this could happen, someone had to transform it from a fantasy to a very real place. This chapter gives you the lowdown on how that came about and directs you to the places in the book that give you the nitty-gritty in more detail. They came, they saw, they stayed. The first Americans probably wandered over from Asia about 14,000 years ago, which in geologic terms is an eye-blink ago. Over the succeeding 4 or 5 millennia, they spread out over the North and South American continents. There weren't a whole lot of these first Americans, at least not in what became known as the United States of America, but they were wildly diverse in their customs and culture. Many of the differences had to do with the environment in which they settled. Around AD 985, Northern Europeans, popularly known as Vikings, showed up on the North American continent, but stuck around only long enough to irritate the Native Americans. But two things, greed and imagination, prodded other Europeans into taking their place. Looking for a new route to the riches of the East, particularly spices, explorers such as an Italian weaver's son named Christopher Columbus thought they might sail west around the globe until they hit Asia. Of course, the Americas got in the way. Rather than reverse course, Columbus and his counterparts refocused their priorities to exploring and exploiting the New World. The exploiting part of that plan included enslaving or killing off the native population. Sometimes the killing was deliberate. Sometimes it was inadvertent, through the introduction of diseases for which the Native Americans had no defenses, for example. See Chapter 2 for more details on Native Americans and explorers. Catching up to the Spanish. Spain got a head start in the Americas, mainly because it was the first to get enthusiastic about exploring the Americas. But other European countries eagerly sought to catch up. France split its efforts between colonizing and just carting off resources like fish and furs. But the English took steps to make their presence more permanent. English settlements were founded for both economic and ecclesiastical reasons. In the South, colonists hoped to make money by growing tobacco, and later, cotton. To make their enterprises more profitable, they imported slaves from Africa. It was a practice that would prove far costlier in terms of human misery than the crops were ever worth. In the North, settlers who had fled religious persecution established colonies based more on religious principles than making a buck, although they weren't averse to the latter. Like the Spanish, English settlers often found the easiest way to deal with the Native Americans was to shove them aside or kill them. The English colonies grew rapidly. Chapter 3 has the stories of pilgrims, Puritans, and entrepreneurs. It's revolutionary. It was probably of small comfort to the Native Americans, but the French and British also spent an inordinate amount of time killing each other. Throughout much of the 18th century, the two nations squared off in a series of wars that were fought in both Europe and the New World. When the dust settled, Britain had cemented its position as top dog among the European powers in North America. But a new power, whose members increasingly called themselves Americans, was beginning to assert itself. Stung by slights, both real and imagined, from the mother country, American colonists grew restless under British control. In 1776, after a series of provocations and misunderstandings, the colonies declared themselves independent. Details about the pre-revolution period are in Chapter 4. The American Revolution took 7 years for the colonists to win. To do so took a brilliant leader in George Washington, a timely ally in France, and healthy helpings of tenacity and luck. Chapter 5 has the details. Making a country out of the victorious colonies also took tenacity, luck, and genius. Over the summer of 1787, a remarkable group of men gathered in Philadelphia to draw up the rules for the new nation. The United States of America elected Washington as its first president, set up a reasonable financial system, and avoided war with European countries long enough to get itself established. All these events are in Chapter 6. Putting America on the Map. Thomas Jefferson was a great example of America finding the right man at the right time. He helped the country make a smooth transition from one political party being in charge to another. Plus, he had the imagination to pull off a pretty big land deal, the Louisiana Purchase. That not only doubled the size of the country, it gave Lewis and Clark a good reason for an expedition. Meanwhile, the U.S. Supreme Court asserted itself as a co-equal branch of government. That's all in Chapter 7, along with fighting pirates and getting into another war with Great Britain. Spoiler alert, it ended in a draw. Nationalizing a nation. The end of the War of 1812 also marked the fading of the Revolution generation. People increasingly began to identify themselves as Americans rather than New Yorkers or Virginians. But it wasn't the end of tensions among sections of the country when their interests diverged. Those divergent issues included fights over banking, tariffs, and especially slavery. With the invention of the cotton gin, growing the fiber became quite profitable in the South, and along with a surge in sugar growing, made the region intensely dependent on slave labor. Many people in northern states opposed slavery for a variety of moral, political, and economic reasons. A fight over the question of allowing slavery to spread was avoided, at least temporarily, with a fragile compromise in 1820. Beyond its borders, the United States was nervously watching European nations who were avariciously watching former Spanish colonies in Latin America gain their independence. In 1823, President James Monroe formally warned Europe to keep its hands off of the Americas. Not all the political squabbling was international. In 1824, a crusty military man-turned-politician named Andrew Jackson lost a hotly contested and controversial election to John Quincy Adams. In 1828, Jackson avenged the loss after one of the sleaziest campaigns, by both sides, in U.S. history. As president, Jackson found himself confronted by a theory, most eloquently championed by South Carolina Senator John C. Calhoun, called nullification. It held that states could decide for themselves which federal laws they did and did not have to obey. The theory served to deepen the divide between North and South. Despite a national recession brought on by speculation and shady financial dealings, Americans were busy coming up with ways to make life better. Improvements in equipment triggered a boom in railroad building. The development of steel plows and rolling harvesters greatly enhanced grain production. And the invention of the telegraph signaled the start of a national communications medium. Down in Texas, meanwhile, American expatriates led a successful revolt against Mexico and then waited for 9 years to become part of the United States. The annexation of Texas, in turn, helped start another war. Chapter 8 has a lot of stuff in it. Fighting with a neighbor. In 1844, America elected its first dark horse, or surprise, presidential candidate. He was James K. Polk. Polk was a hard worker with a yen to expand the country to the Pacific Ocean by acquiring territory from Mexico. Polk saw it as the nation's manifest destiny. Mexico saw it as intolerable bullying. After the Mexican government refused to sell, Polk sent U.S. troops to the border. A fight was quickly provoked and just as quickly escalated into a war. The Americans' quick and decisive victory resulted in their grabbing of about 500,000 square miles of Mexican territory, comprising much of what became the Western United States. These actions not only fulfilled Polk's vision of manifest destiny, but also gave California to America. That addition proved to be particularly fortuitous when gold was discovered there in early 1848. By the end of 1849, the California gold rush had sparked a human stampede and given America all the elbow room it would need for decades. That was a good thing, because immigration was again booming, particularly from Ireland and the European states that would become Germany. But the acquisition of Mexican territory also renewed the struggle to balance the interests of slave states and free states. In 1850, Congress worked out a five-bill compromise. California was added as a free state. The free or slave question was postponed in other areas of the former Mexican lands, and Congress enacted a law that made it easier for slave owners to recover fugitive slaves. While a movement to give women rights and opportunities equal to men's began to gather steam in the 1850s, the slavery issue overshadowed it. Violence broke out in Kansas and Virginia. An 1857 Supreme Court decision that held that slaves had no more rights than mules infuriated slavery opponents. And in 1860, the badly divided country gave a plurality of its votes to a 51-year-old Illinois lawyer in a four-way race for the presidency. The election of Abraham Lincoln was the last straw for Southern states, which began leaving the Union. See Chapter 9 for accounts of the war with Mexico, the California Gold Rush, and America's divorce from itself. Fighting among ourselves. Talk about timing. America had its best president at the worst time in its history, the Civil War. Underestimating Lincoln was easy, and many did. But he had a knack for getting the best out of most of the people around him and a self-deprecating sense of humor that disarmed others. Lincoln was no fan of slavery, but even more important to him was preserving the Union. The North seemed well equipped to accomplish that. It had a larger population, better manufacturing and transportation systems, and an established navy and central government. The South had the home field advantage in better military leaders, and it only had to fight to a draw. While the North was largely successful in establishing a naval blockade of southern ports, the South won most of the early land battles. Its best general, Robert E. Lee, even succeeded in taking the fight to northern territory for a while. But eventually, the North's superiority in numbers and supplies asserted itself, and the tide turned. It took 4 years and 600,000 American lives for Northern forces to prevail, restore the Union, and end slavery. But less than a week after the surrender of the South's main army, Lincoln was assassinated. With him went the nation's best chance of healing its wounds. The details are in Chapter 10. Making up is hard to do. The post-war South was a mess, and that's putting it mildly. The infrastructure was wrecked, the economy in shambles, and the best and brightest of its leaders gone. Millions of African Americans were free, with no education, no place to work, and nowhere to go. With Lincoln gone, many of the North's leaders were more in the mood for revenge than for Reconstruction. Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's successor, had few friends in Congress and fewer leadership skills. Such a climate resulted in the North imposing draconian laws on the South, which led, in turn, to economic and physically violent reprisals by white Southerners on black Southerners. Reconstruction efforts suffered further when the great Northern general, Ulysses S. Grant, turned out to be a not-so-great president. Political corruption infected every level of government. The corruption peaked, or bottomed out, with a sleazy deal that gave the 1876 presidential election to a former governor named Rutherford B. Hayes. It's all there in Chapter 11. Struggling with greatness. With the North-South struggle over, America began stretching west in earnest. Great tracts of land were available to settle, and money could be made in mining, ranching, and farming. Tragically, that meant pushing out or bumping off the original human residents. Most of America's surviving Native Americans were on the Great Plains. But by 1890, wars, murders, disease, starvation, and forced emigration had largely solved the Indian problem. Other minorities fared little better. In the South, the failures of the Reconstruction led to a series of Jim Crow laws that sanctioned racial segregation. Immigration from China was temporarily banned in 1882, and the ban lasted 6 decades. Immigrants from other nations poured in, however, many of them populating vast slums in rapidly growing cities. But big business boomed in what Mark Twain dubbed the Gilded Age. Railroads, steel, and oil were the objects of monopolistic cartels, and new industries sprang up around new inventions like the telephone and electric lighting. With its frontier rapidly settled, America cast its eyes beyond its borders. In 1898, it went to war with Spain. The conflict lasted 4 months and resulted in Guam, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines becoming U.S. territories. See Chapter 12 for details. Finding a place in the world. As the 20th century began, the nation marched along to the twin drums of imperialism, running other people's countries for America's benefits, and progressivism, improving the bad habits of big business and big politics. At the forefront of both was a human dynamo named Theodore Roosevelt. The country was also undergoing labor pains, with unions striving, often violently and not very successfully, with business leaders. Women were also struggling to gain a place in the polling booth and in the pay line. Chapter 13 winds up with America trying to stay out of World War I and failing. America's participation in the war turned out to be a good thing for the rest of the world, as it helped the war get over with sooner. Roaring through the 20s. After the war, America decided to mind its own business and restricted immigration to keep the rest of the world out. It also gave up drinking, at least legal drinking. Prohibition resulted in a lot of illegal drinking, which seemed in turn to affect the country's mores in other areas. America also elected a string of rock-ribbed Republicans as president, all of whom did what they could to make the rich richer. Everyone else may do by buying things on installment plans and looking for ways to get rich themselves. And Americans spent their increasing leisure time going to the movies, listening to the radio, and paying homage to heroes like Babe Ruth and Charles Lindbergh. As Chapter 14 closes, the Roaring Twenties sputter to an end with a stock market crash, which makes for a depressing next chapter. What's so great about a depression? A whole fistful of factors helped cause the Great Depression. The stock market crash, a host of bank and farm failures, even terrible weather. It all added up to an economically catastrophic decade. Unemployment and foreclosures soared. Tens of thousands of farm families migrated to the promise of better times in California. Minority groups were even worse off than usual. About the only groups to make progress were labor unions. Trying to untangle the mess was a patrician New Yorker named Franklin D. Roosevelt. As president, FDR launched an alphabet's worth of federal programs to combat the Depression, with mixed results. For Depression distractions, America had an array of demagogic politicians, dangerous criminals, and long-winded radio personalities. They're all right there in Chapter 15. The Big One. As the 1930s ended, most Americans were too preoccupied with their own problems to worry about problems in the rest of the world. As it turned out, however, the country couldn't get by indefinitely just selling war materials to friendly nations. By the end of 1941, America was in another world war, and the country was up to the task. Industrial production was ramped up. Women went to work, taking the place of men at war. Minority groups gained ground in the struggle for equality by making invaluable contributions to the effort. American efforts overseas were even more valiant. After helping to secure North Africa, U.S. troops were at the vanguard of the Allied invasions of Italy and France. In the Pacific, the military recovered quickly from the devastating attack on Pearl Harbor and began a methodical hopscotch across the Pacific. As Chapter 16 concludes, America ends the war by using nuclear weapons and begins a very uneasy chapter in world history. Cold War and a Brave New World. After years of struggling with totalitarian regimes in other countries, America marked the end of World War II by beginning a decades-long struggle with different totalitarian regimes in other countries. Instead of fascists, these were communists, especially those in the Soviet Union, and eventually, China. After helping get the United Nations off the ground, the United States began diplomatically, and sometimes not so diplomatically, dueling with communists who were trying to overthrow governments in other countries. In 1950, UN troops, consisting mainly of U.S. troops, began what was termed a police action, trying to push back a Chinese-supported North Korean invasion of South Korea. It took until mid-1953 and 33,000 U.S. dead to end the war in a stalemate. At home, meanwhile, Americans' antipathy toward communism resulted in demagogic persecution of U.S. citizens. Commie hunting became something of a national pastime. It took until mid-1954 for a poison of innuendo and smear tactics spread by a Wisconsin senator named Joe McCarthy to run its course. Communist aside, Americans were doing pretty well after the war. Returning veterans came home to plenty of jobs and government aid programs, which meant a booming economy. People bought houses and cars in new suburban communities, where they watched a new cultural phenomenon called television and listened to a new kind of music called rock and roll. But not everyone was having fun. After helping win two world wars, African Americans decided it was past time to be treated as equals. A 1954 U.S. Supreme Court decision and a 1955 boycott of a bus company helped jumpstart the civil rights movement, It's all in Chapter 17. From a Kennedy to a Ford. After 8 years of Dwight Eisenhower, a great general but a pretty dull president, America was ready for some charisma in the White House. It got it with the election of John F. Kennedy in 1960. Kennedy proved his leadership skills in 1962 when he pulled the country and the rest of the world back from the brink of nuclear war over the presence of Soviet missiles in Cuba. But his assassination the following year ended the promise of his presidency. In Kennedy's place came Lyndon B. Johnson, a practiced politician. Johnson inherited a messy U.S. involved in a civil war in Vietnam, which grew increasingly messier in his 5 years in office. Anti-war sentiment grew almost as fast and kept Johnson from seeking a second full term. At home, the civil rights movement that began in the 50s picked up speed in the 60s, fueled by a confluence of Johnson-pushed federal legislation. Nonviolent demonstrations led, most notably by the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., and the violence of race riots in many U.S. cities. African Americans weren't the only ones protesting. Latinos, women, and gay and lesbian Americans took their grievances to the streets. Young people embraced freer attitudes toward drugs, sex, and personal appearance. Their parents, meanwhile, elected Richard Nixon president twice. Except for Vietnam, Nixon enjoyed reasonable success in foreign policy, warming up relations with China and gingerly seeking middle ground with the Soviet Union. After expanding the U.S. role in Vietnam by bombing targets in neighboring Cambodia, Nixon administration officials decided it was time to exit and announced a peace settlement with North Vietnam in early 1973. At home, Nixon's paranoid fixation on getting even with political foes led to a spying and lying scandal that, in turn, led him to becoming the only U.S. president to resign his office. The Watergate dirt is in Chapter 18. Good intentions, mixed results. After Nixon quit, the country had two very good men, who were not very good presidents, Gerald R. Ford and Jimmy Carter. Ford angered many Americans by pardoning Nixon of any crimes connected with the Watergate scandal. Carter, who defeated Ford in the 1976 presidential race, angered many Americans by pardoning Vietnam War draft dodgers. And both men had trouble with a national economy that suffered from runaway inflation and an embargo by oil-producing nations that resulted in long lines and high prices at gas stations. Carter did broker a peace deal between Egypt and Israel, but he also oversaw a mess in America's relations with Iran. The successor to Ford and Carter was seemingly about as improbable a presidential choice as America ever made. A former B-movie actor who had served two unremarkable terms as governor of California. But Ronald Reagan turned out to have as much impact on the country as any president since FDR. He was charismatic, optimistic, stubborn, decisive, and lucky, all of which were just what the country needed to restore its self-confidence. An ardent anti-communist, Reagan heated up the Cold War, in part by proposing an ambitious Star Wars military program based on laser-shooting satellites. But his tenacity, combined with tough economic and political times in the Soviet Union, pushed the Soviet bloc closer to its demise in the late 80s and early 90s. Chapter 19 ends with the one-term presidency of George H.W. Bush, a short war with Iraq, the worst riot in a U.S. city in a century, and the election of a president whose hometown was Hope. Really? Finishing out the century. A native of Hope, Arkansas, Bill Clinton was the nation's first president born after the end of World War II. Although he successfully pushed for a major trade agreement with Canada and Mexico and helped restore some order in the war-torn states of the former Yugoslavia, most of the Democratic president's energies were aimed at domestic issues. A major effort to reform America's healthcare system failed, but he was more successful in working with a Republican majority in Congress to reform the welfare system. He also shone when it came to economic matters, turning a federal budget deficit into a surplus and a 1993 tax hike into a 1997 tax cut after he won re-election in 1996. But in 1998, Clinton was caught lying about a sexual affair with a White House intern. The GOP-controlled House impeached him, and he became the second president to be tried by the Senate. Andrew Johnson was the first in 1868. The Senate acquitted the president, mostly on the grounds that getting caught with a zipper down and trying to cover it up wasn't sufficient reason to throw him out of office. Clinton's budgetary success was tied to the overall success of the U.S. economy in the 90s. That, in turn, was driven by technological advances, home computers, cell phones, the Internet, that helped foster tighter economic ties with the rest of the world. But the 90s also saw the broadening of America's experience with a problem it heretofore had associated mostly with other countries: terrorism. Bombings of the World Trade Center in New York City, of a federal office complex in Oklahoma City, and at the 1996 Olympic Games in Atlanta brought home the chilling realization that America wasn't immune from horrific acts of sudden mass violence. The country also battled the less sudden but more widespread problems of illicit drug use and the spread of AIDS. And as Chapter 20 and the 20th century ends, America and the rest of the world found themselves on the cusp of technological and economic changes that made a seemingly smaller planet spin at a faster pace. America in the 21st century. There's nothing like kicking off a new millennium with a nail-bitingly close presidential election, and that's where Chapter 21 begins. The contest between George W. Bush, the eventual winner, and Al Gore wasn't decided until 7 weeks after the polls closed, and only then by a 5-4 U.S. Supreme Court decision. Over the 8 years of the Bush presidency, America suffered the worst terrorist attack in modern times, got into 2 wars, toppled 1 dictator, and got hit with a couple of nasty hurricanes. All in all, it's 1 untidy chapter. Bursting economic bubbles. As the biggest economic calamity to hit the country since the 1930s, the Great Recession seemed to warrant its own chapter, which is what Chapter 22 is all about. People lost their houses and their jobs at dizzying rates. As it had in the Great Depression, the federal government tried to fix things with ambitious and expensive programs. And as America gradually got back on its fiscal feet, it found its economy had reshaped itself into a form that didn't fit all Americans the same. Politics and healthcare are no tea party. In 2008, the country elected an African-American as its president for the first time. Barack Obama faced a deeply divided nation when it came to choosing which political philosophy to be guided by, on issues that ranged from federal government spending to devising an efficient and broad-based healthcare system. Take a look at Chapter 23 to see how it worked out for him. Stormy times and a new kind of president. The economy was humming along. America was still the world's most dominant country when it came to military might and cultural influence. And yet the nation was perhaps more deeply divided along ideological, political, and financial lines than it had been since the Civil War. Part of the reason was a new president, who was either loved or hated. There seemed to be no middle ground when it came to assessing Donald J. Trump. Elected in one of the biggest upsets in U.S. presidential history, Trump's approach to governing seemed to stir controversy at every turn, and in nearly every part of the world. At home, meanwhile, Americans struggled with problems that ranged from opioid addiction and gun violence to hurricanes, sexual harassment, and racial divides. It all makes for an unsettling Chapter 24. Changing Technology, Changing America. As the new century moved along, Americans found themselves riding a wave of technological innovation that upended old ways of news gathering, communicating, socializing, shopping, and entertaining. The new technology also crept into the country's political processes in sometimes troubling ways. At the same time, changes in both the demographics, a lot of people got a lot older, and cultural norms were dramatically reshaping who Americans were and how they lived. The new reflection is revealed in Chapter 25. Chapter 2. Native Americans and Explorers, 14,000 B.C. To 1607. In this chapter, examining the early civilizations in the Americas, understanding Native American tribes, visiting by Viking ships, recounting the exploits of Columbus and other explorers. Because U.S. history is most often written about by the descendants of Europeans, me included, there has been a tendency to overemphasize the experiences of European settlers at the expense of others who drop by the New World, Native Americans included. But tracking what the Native Americans did can be difficult because they left no written records of their activities. In this chapter, I make some educated guesses and then get on with all those Europeans. Coming to America. Once upon a time, about 14,000 years ago, some people from what is now Siberia walked across what was then a land bridge, but is now the Bering Strait, and into what is now Alaska. They were hunters in search of ground sloths the size of hippopotamuses, armadillos the size of Volkswagens, mammoth-sized mastodons, and other really big game. They weren't in any kind of hurry. Their descendants kept walking south for 4,000 or 5,000 years, not stopping until they got to Patagonia, at the tip of South America. Along the way, they split up and spread out until people could be found in all parts of the continents and islands of North and South America. Maybe. Remember, actually, no one knows when humans first showed up in the New World. For most of the 20th century, the most widely accepted view among scholars was the one told in the preceding paragraphs. People got to the Americas by walking across a land bridge during the Ice Age, when there was more ice and the water level of the world's oceans was lower than it is today. But recent discoveries have caused many scientists to think Americans, in one form or another, have been around a lot longer. Archaeological sites in Alaska, Oregon, Florida, Chile, and other places have yielded clues, such as tools, animal bones carved and smashed by humans, and even DNA from human remains, that indicate people may have been in the Americas for as long as 20,000 to even 40,000 years. And there is evidence that despite the presence of the land bridge, thousands of square miles of ice on the North American side would have been too difficult to cross. If that's the case, Americans may very well have come some other way, such as by water. One theory is that the first Americans followed the kelp highway, traveling by boat and hugging the shoreline where they would have found food, such as shellfish. Imagine being the first guy in your tribe to put an oyster or lobster in your mouth. The boat people were followed, the theory goes, by those crossing the land bridge when the vast ice fields retreated, but before water covered the bridge. Other puzzles have popped up to cause scientists to look hard at the Bering Strait theory. One study of human blood types, for example, found that the predominant blood type in Asia is B, and the blood types of Native Americans are almost exclusively A or O. This finding seems to indicate that at least some of the Native Americans' ancestors came from somewhere other than Siberia. Exploring Early Civilizations. Although it's unclear who got here first and when, it's known that the forerunners of Native Americans were beginning to settle down by about 1000 BC. They cultivated crops, most notably maize, a hardy variety of corn that takes less time to grow than other grains and can also grow in many different climates. Beans and squash made up the other two of the three sisters of early American agriculture. Growing their own food enabled the groups to stay in one place for long periods of time. Consequently, they could make and acquire things and build settlements, which allowed them to trade with other groups. Trading resulted in groups becoming covetous of other groups' things, which eventually led to wars over these things. Civilization. Technical stuff. Getting the point. In the early 1930s, researchers near Clovis, New Mexico, found long spearheads made of chert, obsidian, and other stone materials. The spearheads, which were found with the bones of dead animals, had grooves in their base, where they could be attached to wooden shafts and hurled with great force by using a throwing stick. These spearheads have since been found in a wide area of North America. Scientists called them Clovis points and offered them as proof that man was here during the Ice Age. Many scientists believe the point-chucking hunters were so efficient that they helped hasten the extinction of most of the period's great animals. For decades, it was believed the Clovis people represented the oldest widespread culture in the Americas. Although that belief became widely disputed in recent years, it's well accepted that most modern Native American people can trace their ancestry to the Clovis folks. The Anasazi. One of the earliest cultures to emerge in what's now the United States was the Anasazi. The group's name comes from a Navajo word that has been translated to mean ancient people or ancient enemies. Although they were around the southwestern United States for hundreds of years, they flourished from about AD 1100 to 1300. At their peak, the Anasazi built adobe-walled towns in nearly inaccessible areas, which made the communities easy to defend. The towns featured apartment houses, community courts, and buildings for religious ceremonies. The Anasazi made artistic pottery and tightly woven baskets. The baskets were so good, the culture is sometimes referred to as the basket makers. Because of the region's arid conditions, the Anasazi people couldn't support a large population and were never numerous. But just why their culture died out so suddenly around the beginning of the 14th century is a puzzle to archaeologists. One theory is that a prolonged drought simply made life unsustainable in the region. A more controversial theory is that marauding Indians from Mexico conquered the Anasazi or drove them off. However the Anasazi's demise came about, their culture was developed enough to be reflected in some of the Southwest tribes of today. The Mound Builders. East of the Anasazi were groups of early Americans who became known as mound builders, after their habit of erecting large earthworks that served as tombs and foundations for temples and other public buildings. One group, known as the Woodland Culture, was centered in Ohio and spread east. Their mounds, which took decades to build, reached more than 7 stories in height and were surrounded by earthwork walls as long as 500 yards. The largest of these mounds was near what's now the southern Ohio town of Hopewell. The largest mound builder settlement was on the Illinois side of the Mississippi River, about 8 miles from what's now St. Louis. It was called Cahokia. At its zenith, around AD 1100, Cahokia covered 6 square miles and may have been home to as many as 30,000 people. To put that in perspective, Cahokia was about the same size as London was in 1100, and no other city in America grew to that size until Philadelphia did 700 years later. The residents of Cahokia had a knack for astronomy, building, and human sacrifice. Their largest mounds, like pyramids of cultures in Mexico, were four-sided, had a flat top, and covered as much ground as the biggest pyramids of Egypt. The Cahokia mound builders also had a penchant for constructing stout, wooden stockades around their city. In doing so, however, they cut down most of the trees in the area, which reduced the amount of game in the region and caused silt to build up in nearby waterways. The city also may have suffered from nasty air pollution because of wood fires that were constantly burning. By 1200, people were leaving Cahokia and its suburbs in large numbers. By 1400, the city was abandoned, an early victim of the ills of urban growth. Many tribes, not many people. Although what's now the United States didn't have a lot of Native Americans, maybe 1 million to 1.5 million or so at the time of Christopher Columbus's arrival in 1492, it certainly had a wide variety. Historians estimate that at least 250 different tribal groups lived in America at that time. Some estimates have put the number of distinct societies as high as 1,200. They spoke at least 300 languages, none of them written, and many of the languages were as different from each other as Chinese is from English. In the Northwest, the Northwest Indians were avid traders. Acquisitions of material goods, including slaves, resulted in higher status, and gift-giving and ceremonies called potlatches marked public displays of wealth. Tribes such as the Chinook, the Salishan, and the Maka lived in well-organized, permanent villages of 100 or more. Abundant fish and a mild climate made many of the tribes relatively prosperous, especially because they dried fish to save for the times of the year when food was less available. The Northwest cultures carved elaborate and intricate totem poles, which represented their ancestral heritage. In the Southwest, arid conditions made life tougher for tribes in the Southwest. Tribes such as the Apache were foragers, scrounging for everything from bison to grasshoppers, while tribes such as the Hopi scratched out an existence as farmers. In what's now California, most of the scores of different tribes were pretty laid back. They lived in villages as hunters and gatherers. On the Great Plains, game, especially bison, was plentiful on the plains. But hunting bison was tough on foot, and the Plains Indians didn't have horses until the mid-16th century. Eventually, the tribes domesticated the wild offspring of horses that Spanish explorers brought from the Old World, and tribes like the Cheyenne and Lakota became expert riders. Until then, the Plains tribes made do by stalking, ambushing, and occasionally stampeding a herd of bison over a cliff. The tribes were semi-nomadic. They packed up their teepees and moved on when the local food got scarce. In the Northeast, tribes fell into two large language groups in the Northeast, the Iroquoian and the Algonquian. Because history shows that human beings divided into two groups but living in the same area tend to fight, guess what? They fought a lot. Both groups used tools and weapons made of copper or slate, which they traded back and forth when they weren't fighting. The Northeast Indians lived in communal longhouses and invented a light, maneuverable canoe made out of birch bark. A remarkable event involving the Northeast tribes occurred around 1450, when five tribes, the Cayugas, Mohawks, Oneidas, Onondagas, and Senecas, formed the Iroquois League. The purpose of this league was to form an alliance against the Algonquin and settle disputes among themselves. Some scholars believe the uniting of individual tribes for a common cause may have been studied by the country's founding fathers, particularly Benjamin Franklin, when they were putting together the Federalist form of government after the American Revolution. Native American gifts. Native American contributions to modern culture are plentiful, varied, and often overlooked. They include the names of 27 states and thousands of rivers, lakes, mountains, cities, and towns. Foods such as potatoes, sweet potatoes, artichokes, squash, turkey, tomatoes, vanilla, cacao, which is used to make chocolate, and maple sugar. Medicines like coca, used to make Novocaine, quinine, curare, and ipecac. And other items such as hammocks, toboggans, parkas, ponchos, and snowshoes. Oh yeah, and tobacco too. In the Southeast. The dominant tribes in the Southeast included the Cherokees, the Choctaws, the Chickasaws, the Creeks, and the Seminoles. These tribes got by through a mix of hunting, gathering, and farming. Europeans would later refer to them as the Five